Good afternoon and welcome to Radio Estina for today, Tuesday, September 16th, 2008. I'm Alex Linder. Estina is the opposite of Pravda, the noble truth, that is the lie, the big lie, as associated with the Russian Revolution, which is really a Jewish communist revolution, and the same forces which control America today and press pretty much the same agenda. Today, we're not going to take a long time. We're going to go a little quicker. It's not going to last for 3 hours. What we're going to talk about is an article in Culture Wars, and then we're going to also, I'm going to read a chapter or two from The Nameless War, a book which was written by a British military man, basically talking about the centuries-long war between Jews and whites. And essentially adumbrating or discussing in a short, sketchy way what Jones discusses at great length. Ramsay's book is only about 120 pages long, whereas Jones is about 10 times that, but they cover a good deal of the same ground, although not from a Catholic perspective in the case of Ramsay. Now, let's see here. I'm trying to get the sound levels right. Okay. Now, what we want to talk about is from Culture Wars. In the June 2008 edition, and this is a discussion of the other side of the church priest sex abuse cases, and it's just an interesting story written by Richard Goldkamp, who I'm going to assume is a German Catholic rather than a Jewish convert or writer. But anyway, in Culture Wars, he goes into it at some length, the way that the media has portrayed the sex abuse problems in the Catholic Church versus the reality, and I think it's a good example of a political but non-white nationalist view of how the media alters things. And as I said, that will be our first segment. Our second segment will be The Nameless War by Ramsay, and we'll talk about, we've talked about this before, and I've read some of it before. We will do chapters 3 to 5 of that book, and I will literally read it and make some comments where appropriate. It's not very long, and it's quite interesting. This is a book that you will not find in any library. You can find it to buy online. That's true with many of these, but you won't find them commonly in bookstores or college libraries, even, let alone regular public libraries. But let's begin with the sex abuse. Again, this is from June, from Culture Wars, which you can find at culturewars.com. That's Michael Jones's monthly magazine. And it's from the June 2008 article called Snap Judgment, with the judgment misspelled. There is no E in judgment except for the M-E-N-T. It's J-U-D-G-M-E-N-T in America. There is an extra E in the British way of spelling it. Anyhow, he says, at a certain point during his recent visit to the United States, it looked as though the only thing that Pope Benedict XVI was going to be allowed to speak about was the sex abuse crisis. After addressing the issue on the plane flight over here, the talking heads turned the sex abuse crisis into the universal hermeneutic, that is, interpretation. That's the only lens through which you're allowed to see the church. No matter what the Pope said, the commentators returned to the topic of sex abuse. The New York Times was by no means the worst offender in this regard, but the sexual abuse was the lens, nonetheless, through which they viewed everything else, including the speech to Catholic educators and the mass in Nationals Park in Washington. And again, in other articles that Jones has had in his magazine, he's talked about the ADL's cooperation with the Catholic publishing house that feeds most of the, I think they're called seminaries, the places where the priests and the nuns are trained, and special lessons that they have for them, just the way that they have a world of difference to pollute the minds of kids in public schools. They go about privately trying to, whatever they can use their influence, legally or illegally, you will find them doing just that. And what it is essentially teaching your kids big lies as though they're the truth. Whether your kids are in a private parochial Catholic school or whether they're in the so-called public school. Always the Jews will promote that which destroys, whether it's homosexuality, lying about Jesus, or race mixing, and always they will deny what is good. That's how Jews are. If you think of them as the embodiment of evil, evil in human form, as I've often said, you will be able to pick out their agenda immediately. Any kind of settled pattern, you think about, how would I go about destroying this if that were my goal? And what you arrive at will be precisely the Jewish agenda. So the Pope comes over here, and the papers, all they want to talk about is sex abuse by Catholic priests. The lead article in the Times on Friday, April 18, 2008, was titled, Benedict Meets with Victims of Sexual Abuse. And according to authors Ian Fisher and Lori Goodstein, that meeting, quote, made clear for all the messages that Benedict wished to send during his five-day trip to the U.S., his first as Pope, the ones concerning priestly abuse were central. And again, there's typos. Jones puts out so much material, I guess he can't proofread it or something. Anyway, Jew writers for a Jew paper are saying that the Pope's central message in his first visit to the U.S. relates to priests abusing kids or teenagers. And we'll see that that's one of the major bones to pick here, is what the newspapers, which promote homosexuality, call pedophilia, is often, in fact, homosexuality. That is, priests going after teenagers rather than kids. In case you didn't get the message, the same authors continued a bit later by saying that the unannounced meeting far overshadowed the rest of the Pope's schedule, in their opinion. Far overshadowed as well was the rest of the story. During the first week of January 2008, an Associated Press story out of Dallas revealed that an innocent 47-year-old black man had been released by a judge only after he had spent 27 years in prison on a charge of rape. While Charles Chapman had refused to admit he was a rapist in several appearances before a parole board, new DNA evidence finally proved to a court that he was not, in fact, guilty as originally charged. His case only added to Dallas County's national reputation as a venue for wrongly accused inmates. Unlikely as it may seem to the Catholic Church's most ardent critics, it is high time to explore an embarrassing but closely related question in the wake of hefty damage suit settlements over clerical sex abuse. How many innocent priests have been similarly targeted by false accusations? As we shall see, it is far from an irrelevant question. In the midst of the media feeding frenzy over sex abuse in the clergy 6 years ago, a guest column on the subject turned up at the thriving regional daily where I work in the St. Louis metro area. It was essentially a bitter critique of Catholic bishops' efforts to deal with the crisis at hand. But that November 6, 2002, column in the Belleville, Illinois, News Democrat conveyed the mystifying notion that a Catholic priest faced only minor inconvenience at worst if one was ever falsely accused. Quote unquote. The author enclosed that phrase in quotes to make his point clear. He was obviously skeptical any Catholic clergyman had ever been subjected to such a thing, that is, false accusation. The very idea that a grown man might allege he was sexually abused by a priest when he was much younger appeared alien to this writer's way of thinking. The columnist in question was none other than David Clohessy, C-L-O-H-E-S-S-Y. David Clohessy, National Director of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or the acronym SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. His column would eventually turn into one of the more ironic offshoots of the transformation of Snap into a public icon for justice. In the first half of the decade, in fact, the story of clergy sex abuse was told almost entirely from Snap's point of view. So you would have the Jew-controlled mass media using this organization to interpret everything that happens in an institution that the mass media mongers hate. That would be the Catholic Church. So they're going to use whatever they can to misrepresent what's actually going on in order to serve their agenda, as they do with global warming and World War II and everything else. Yet despite serious flaws that began showing up in Snap's reaction to the sex abuse issue, its leadership remained virtually immune to any of the corrosive skepticism the secular media, that is the Jew-controlled media, reserved for leaders of the church. One result, so what he's saying is they're treating the church one way. They're assuming it's guilty, and they're treating anyone who accuses it, who after all is helping their agenda, as the good guy, and not questioning, refraining from using the skepticism they normally apply to the church to the church's accusers. A cloud of suspicion was not only spread over the heads of priests and prelates who had invited it. That suspicion also tainted the, well, he says, Snap was basically treated unskeptically. One result was an insidious new kind of collateral damage. A cloud of suspicion was not only spread over the head of the priests and the prelates who invited it. That suspicion also tainted the image of innocent bishops and church leaders who made active efforts very early to arrest this scandal. My own archdiocese, says Goldkamp, serves as only one example. And that Goldkamp's a good example. Not every name like that, Goldkamp or Goldberg or Westerberg or whatever, not all of those names that end in Berg or Stein are Jewish. Remember, the Jews took those names from existing German names, surnames. So Goldkamp says, my own archdiocese serves as only one example. A clergyman named James Beine, B-E-I-N-E, was removed from priestly service there back in 1977 after signs of deviant sexual behavior on his part turned up. Journalists regularly bought into David Clohessy's grim assessment of every Catholic priest that an accuser turned up on his radar screen, as if the church were permanently stuck in the media's feeding frenzy of 2002. What that did was to render the diocesan press powerless to do anything about it. Yet, ironically, Mr. Clohessy was not only unwilling to acknowledge the clearly beneficial impact of church reforms, even worse, he has never had to face up to some gross errors and snap judgments of accused priests. Snap feeding naturally into snap judgments. The time has come, therefore, to test this group's own credibility in its tug of war with the church and clergy. Doing so does not require anyone to downplay the gravity of sex abuse on young people. It's not only a serious sin from a religious perspective, but in most cases a crime in the civil realm. It can seriously disrupt young lives for prolonged periods. Back in the early 90s, in fact, my initial impression of both Snap and its national director was more favorable than it is now. As a Catholic journalist, I found it impossible to fault an effort to air out a serious problem that desperately needed correction. Embarrassed Catholics had good reason to be upset with clergy misbehavior and the inability of the church hierarchy to halt this problem sooner. But for some time now, Snap has sent out decidedly mixed signals in response to the scandal. In my own Archdiocese of St. Louis, which is David Clohessy's hometown as well, there's a growing perception among many parishioners that Snap's hunger for justice a decade ago slowly morphed into an unrestrained thirst for vengeance today. No one can deny the harm done by errant clergymen, but any signs of recent clergy abuse have all but disappeared over the past decade in one diocese after another. The push for revenge, meanwhile, has slowly damaged Snap's own moral authority while simultaneously brushing aside the validity of actions taken by church leaders to halt the problem. Driven by old resentments and based on the accuser's word alone, Snap's relentless pursuit of priests has touched off a subtle new form of anti-clericalism in our dominant secular culture, an attitude easily hidden behind an apparently noble cause. And he's not mentioning Jews here, but Jews are the ones who run the media, and they're the ones who want to make you think, you know, pedophiles when you think of priests or the Catholic Church, because the church is their 2,000-year-old enemy. And we've heard about that before in discussing the Jewish revolutionary spirit, Jones's book, in which he goes over 2,000 years of Jews and Jews working with Protestants and their attempts to undermine Western social order through the promulgation of revolutionary activity, which he says is identical to sexual immorality, which he details in his other book, Libido Dominandi, which we've dealt with a good deal. As high-profile priests came onto the scene with countless lawsuits over allegations of abuse, Snap's horizon steadily widened into a search for gold and glory. Legal action not only produced settlements with church authorities for real victims of abuse, it also opened the door to false accusations and fraudulent claims. Consider this. Over the past 5 years, at least three widely respected priests in the St. Louis Archdiocese alone have been targeted by accusers, despite strong indications to observers familiar with their situations that none of the three men had ever done what they were accused of. So he's saying that the Snap group, lauded by the media, started off as a good group. They were making honest accusations, but over time, and due to lack of questioning by the same media that celebrated them, they grew into a group that accused people falsely in order to make money and publicity for itself. Yet in all three cases, they were publicly identified and vilified, and their reputation smeared, while their accusers were shielded from public view in smearing these priests' reputations. And remember that the right to face your accuser is one of the oldest, proudest Anglo-Saxon rights. You can't be accused of things anonymously. You have the right to face your accuser. The accusers remained anonymous either by their own choice or because of media reporting policies protecting accusers' identities in sensitive issues like this. For all practical purposes, the first of those cases had long since been resolved in favor of the priest. The second case, however, led to the trial, conviction, and 20-year sentencing in late 2005 of Father Thomas Graham, a priest in his early 70s, whose long and honorable record of pastoral service in a half-dozen parishes worked strongly in his favor. When his case was appealed to the Missouri Supreme Court, the court reversed his conviction a year later by calling attention to an overly liberal interpretation of Missouri statutes of limitation used to prosecute him. So, as we see in the case of so-called hate criminals, those are older white people that the Jews and their servants don't like, they interpret the law as they see fit in order to go after them and convict them decades after the fact, whether they in fact were involved in a crime or not. And we see that both in the case of white people of a political stripe Jews don't like, old Klansmen or old pro-white, pro-Southerners, or in the case of those who emigrated to America or a different country after World War II, in which case the Jews have a special branch of the U.S. government that goes out and tracks them down. And Israel, of course, has asserted its right to prosecute, essentially to deal extrajudicially, that is, outside the law, with anybody at any time for any reason they see fit. And we're subject to all these because we allowed the Jews to take over our country. We allowed them to come in here. We treated them as individuals, even though they were working as a hostile group to overthrow our institutions, to infiltrate and subvert our culture, to gain control over our universities, to buy up our media, to control the new developing technologies of radio and TV, and we use that to allow them to define us to ourselves, until we who would defend the good ways, the ways that we Aryans like to live, Aryans being the scientific word for whites, and now what we see now is the result of that. They are allowed to accuse who they would like. And here we're taking a non-white nationalist view. We're looking at priests that they choose to accuse because it's good for them. It serves their agenda of defaming the Catholic Church by making the priests either laughing stocks or pedophiles. So the Missouri Supreme Court actually reverses the decision. Yet Graham's conviction was overturned on a much more than a legal technicality. Retired lawyer Charlie Spohn, or Spohn, S-P-O-H-N, a Wildwood, Missouri resident and former parishioner of Father Graham's, confirmed that fact when he attended the oral arguments on the appeal of the Graham case in Jefferson City, the capital of Missouri, on September 13, 2006. During courtroom questioning of the state's counsel, Spahn found several justices clearly sharing the defense's doubts about the validity of certain evidence and about witness credibility in the state's case against Graham. The result? His conviction was reversed by a unanimous 7-0 vote of the court. So that tells you the evidence must have been pretty weak indeed, because I'm sure they have a few Judeo-liberals on the Missouri State Supreme Court. The third case involves a civil damage suit that surfaced early in 2006, linking the Reverend Robert Osborne, a Marianist priest and former president of Vianney High School, V-I-A-N-N-E-Y, High School, to vague allegations of sex abuse by a former student at Vianney. Again, this is the third priest out of three who the author Goldkamp is saying were unjustly accused of sex abuse by Snap and others in the 2002 to 2007 period. Acting on his own, St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough initiated an investigation that lasted several months. The prosecutor concluded in early October that there was no evidence at all of criminal conduct on Osborne's part, and no charges were filed. After a delay sought by the plaintiff's attorney on an April 7th trial date set for the civil case, a settlement was reached in early July between the plaintiff and the Marianist order. That is Osborne's, his priestly order is the Marianists. And there's no basis for trying him criminally, but I guess they pushed for a civil trial and they reached a settlement. Under pressure from its insurance company, the order agreed to post the Missouri Child Abuse Hotline phone number at Vianney and educate its staff and students on reporting allegations of abuse. Both sides agreed to keep terms of a financial settlement confidential, and the plaintiff dropped his suit. This is how the left, the Jews, and the state like to go after those of us who don't conform, who are heretics, essentially. They force us to what they wanted to do when they came after VNN, for example, and they didn't succeed because they were in a different state than we are, was to force us to post all of their EEOC rules related to a housing advertisement. They didn't like a classified ad that we ran relating to housing and another one related to employment. They wanted to force me to attend their re-education camp in the various states of Indiana and Ohio, and they also wanted VNN to post notice that we don't discriminate in any ad that we run. And that's the way that they like to operate. So they reached a settlement with this order to force the priest to post, I guess on their webpage, or physically post a sign at their location with the numbers for the Missouri Child Abuse Hotline. This is, of course, even though the state has many times been found guilty, including around here in Kirksville, of under false warrant and false pretenses going in and seizing kids, like from the Heartland Institute, I think it was called, up here. We had a prosecutor, sign what was later determined to be a false warrant and go in and seize about 70 kids because they were jealous that the Christian Heartland Institute was doing a better job dealing with them, and they have a whole huge complex with not too many kids in it, so they felt like they were losing market share to a private institution, and they were willing to abuse their authority to rectify that. And what ended up happening was a judgment was made for about $800,000 against them. I think the guy's name was Mike Waddle here in Kirksville, and he wasn't even fired. He was basically kicked upstairs. So the state calling anyone else a child abuser or proceeding under, you know, false color is accusing someone else of what it's guilty of itself more of the time than anyone. And of course it has the media backing it up, since the state is the authority and the media are the handholders of authority, the handmaids. As for Father Osborne, lawyer Robert Haar, H-A-A-R, said the accused priest did not participate in the settlement for one reason. There was simply nothing to settle on the priest's part. He was prepared to fight for his honor in court. In fact, since he had categorically denied any abuse from the beginning, More than 600 former students and parents from Biani and Chaminade high schools thoroughly agreed. The group had banded together as friends of Father Osborne within weeks of when he was first accused and defended him with a website created for that purpose. Now, says Goldkamp, put all this into its larger context. Snap had been actively involved in the public attack on the reputations of all three of these men, both by playing hardball at press conferences, it called, and by pushing for court action in all three cases. Let's take a closer look at the first of these cases. In early 2002, when the Archdiocese first informed Father Alexander Anderson of an accuser's allegations, Anderson took to the pulpit at a Sunday Mass in his church in Eureka, Missouri, to flatly deny any wrongdoing on his part. So this is Father Alexander Anderson, the first, he along with Osborne, are saying that flatly they're not guilty. And so, uncertain of whether the Archdiocese was in good position to help clear his name, he decided to fight back by filing a defamation suit against his accuser, who nonetheless went ahead with his damage suit against Anderson. In late August of 2002, a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and that's the main paper in the St. Louis area, attributed to David Clohessy the bland opinion that, quote, there were virtually no false accusations of clerical sexual abuse. And we'll find that meme generally wherever a group that the Jews want to privilege over white males makes an allegation against white males that, oh, they never lie. Women never lie about sex abuse, about rape, and victims of Catholic priests never lie about being molested. That's the line the media will take. The Snap leader, Clohessy, had adopted a hard line toward both Anderson and St. Louis Archbishop Justin Regali, R-A-G-A-L-I, in a letter he sent to Regali. The blame for this brutal lawsuit lies squarely on your shoulders, he asserted to the Archbishop. That brutal lawsuit was more than a stray touch of hyperbole for Snap's national director. Clohessy had become a master at painting the worst-case scenario, whether factually well-grounded or not, as the best way for Snap to advance its feverish cause. It was a strategy to keep church leaders on the defensive. More often than not, it seemed to work. By early 2004, the Associated Press reported a church official had persuaded both sides to withdraw their lawsuits after the Archdiocese agreed to help Anderson's troubled accuser with the costs of professional counseling. Tempting as it is to view that as a way to buy off the accuser, putting both the Archdiocese and Father Anderson in a no-win situation, an even more important facet of the story cannot be ignored before rushing to such a judgment. At Father Anderson's own request, the Archdiocese passed the accuser's information along to the St. Louis attorney Jennifer Joyce, St. Louis Circuit Attorney Jennifer Joyce, for further review. Her office found insufficient evidence for any criminal action against the priest. So the common thread in at least two of these cases is that prosecutors reviewed the information and found nothing to act on. Yet Snap called the press conference at the time to showcase Mr. Clohessy's attempt to trump any out-of-court settlement. He's a child molester, he alleged to the Eureka priest. He should not be around kids. The fact that Father Anderson might be the innocent party here never seemed to enter the Snap leader's mind. Perish the thought that it might be the priest, not his alleged victim, who was telling the truth. David Clohessy had once again manipulated a sharp clash in viewpoints into another worst-case scenario that pointed the finger of guilt at one more clergyman. What Snap was doing to the Catholic clergy in St. Louis reversed both the letter and the spirit of a famous principle coined in the 18th century, coined by 18th century British jurist William Blackstone as a guide for those engaged in the pursuit of justice. Better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent suffer. I don't agree with that principle myself. And it certainly doesn't work very well in a diversified, multicultural society. It only works where people are fundamentally innocent. David Clohessy may have been seen as a hero by members of his advocacy group, but his harsh judgments of clergymen without clear complicity in the scandal was slowly turning him into a hero with feet of clay for a growing block of Catholics in his hometown. Remember, these are all three of these priests are in the St. Louis area. This isn't even talking nationwide. They became dissidents to Snap's willingness to pander to one of the nastier stereotypes of this decade, namely the public perception that an accused priest, by definition, is probably a closet pedophile. By contrast, there was widespread skepticism about the validity of the conviction of Father Thomas Graham. It was shared not only by former parishioners, but by various lawyers, police officers, and investigators familiar with his case. Yet Snap's Midwest website continued to push a hyperactive campaign against this priest. In December of 2005, while his case was on appeal, the group sent a letter to Missouri Attorney General Jay Nixon, who's now running for Senate, badgering him to investigate why Regina Clary, C-L-E-R-I, the Archdiocesan Treatment Center for Priests, was allowed to house Father Graham and five other priests lumped together by Snap as pedophiles after being taken out of service by the Archdiocese. The group alleged all six posed a grave threat to children at a nearby daycare center. That website entry, says Goldkamp, piqued my curiosity. Let me clarify why its accuracy was well worth challenging. Properly understood, a pedophile is a specific psychiatric term to describe a bizarre sexual addiction that repeatedly prods an offender to molest prepubescent children. See, that's the distinction there between chicken hawks, or fags who go after young teenagers, and pedophiles who go after prepubescent children. The term was appropriately applied to ex-priest Rudolph Koss, or Kos, K-O-S, of Dallas, or John Geoghegan, or Geoghegan, G-E-O-G-H-A-N, of Boston. He said those were real pedophiles, Rudolph Koss and John Geoghegan. Oftentimes, a pedophile will abuse a long series of kids, some less than 10 years old, before he's caught. The age and innocence of the victims makes his behavior as reprehensible, or even more so, than that of a serial rapist. Yet, a study by John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York concluded a sizable majority of the victims of clergy misconduct were teenage boys at the times of the alleged abuse. That suggested one obvious thing. Homosexuality played a far bigger role in the clergy scandal than pedophilia. So we see the Jews in the media trying to call pedophilia what is actually homosexuality. And because the idea of homosexual priests targeting teenage boys runs against the Jews' broader agenda of loosening up society by promoting promiscuity in all of its forms, including homosexuality, the Jews decide very characteristically, deliberately, and dishonestly to call priests going after 14-year-old boys, say, pedophiles rather than what they properly are, which is fags, homosexuals, and chicken hawks. In addition, psychiatric centers like St. Luke Institute in Silver Spring, Maryland, which has worked with hundreds of errant priests over a period of time, have found significant differences in responses to treatment. There is far more hope for rehabilitating someone linked to abusing one or two young people when compared to the far more guarded prognosis for hardcore pedophiles. But once gay rights proponents began setting off sympathetic vibrations in the dominant secular culture of our time, the pedophile priest label became a cudgel of convenience for those with an axe to grind against the Catholic Church. That's true, but it's the fact that the church is against homosexuality, saying it's immoral, whereas the Jews are in favor of homosexuality for non-Jews because they believe that any form of promiscuity reduces anti-Semitism, because any kind of sexual, moral, financial restraint on the part of the person leads him to self-control, which in turn leads him to view Jews. It may seem a little bit far, but if you get into loose sex or loose morals and whatever, you destroy families or you prevent them from forming. And preventing white families from forming or destroying them advances the Jews' agenda, because those tight, controlled families that are run by their father, as they're supposed to be, denounced by as patriarchs and authoritarian personalities by the Jews, they're basically trying to undo the white nation by undoing its platoons, its families. And so they have to pretend that what they call good in their mass media, homosexuality, are just as good as anything else. They can't have that attributed to priests going after boys. They must be denounced as pedophiles. So when you hear about priests abusing kids, most of what you're hearing about is fags. It's homosexuals. And in fact, they will claim that homosexuals are born, not made, but what you find when you look at the data is that people who are in, even if it's against their will, they're forced to practice these forms of aberrant sexuality. They may become accustomed to that because that's how people are. What they train and they do, they become used to, and they may even like after time, even if they didn't like it initially. While muckraking journalists busily congratulated themselves for their work in exposing the clergy scandal. Oops. Let's go back just a line here. He says, once gay rights proponents began setting off sympathetic vibrations in the dominant secular culture of our time, that is the Jew-controlled media, the pedophile priest label became a cudgel of convenience for those with an axe to grind against the Catholic Church. Mixing metaphors there, but... Loose use of the term perverted the meaning of this scandal in two ways. It not only distorted the real problems of most of the priests involved, it also swept the homosexual connection conveniently under the rug of political correctness in the media elite. While muckraking journalists busily congratulated themselves for their work in exposing the clergy scandal, their temptation to blur all distinctions among sex offenders at the time also helped smear the image of the Catholic priesthood in general far worse than it deserved. The bottom line, unless the term pedophile truly applies, its use should be avoided at all costs against a clergyman or anyone else. So, these three in St. Louis were falsely accused, and of the ones who were accurately accused, the vast majority of them were not in fact pedophiles, they were fags. But the media obscures that because it doesn't like Catholics, and the Jewish way has always been, from Lenin onward and probably long before that, has been associate your opponent, in this case the Catholic Church, with things that are widely hated by the population, such as pedophiles. So they teach you to identify pedophiles and priests, just as they try to teach you that Nazis or white nationalists are also pedophiles, or they associate our kind with sexual deviancy, even while they promote every other kind of sexual deviancy short of pedophilia, and may in fact be working to weaken opposition to that as well, because that's what Jews do. So, says Goldkamp, was Snap really onto something at Regina Clary or not? I checked its appraisal of a specific priest at the retirement home by contacting two nuns who helped care for its aging residents. I also talked with an old friend living there, a retired Monsignor, was familiar with the situation. The result? In the 4 years Father Thomas Graham resided there before his trial, conviction, and subsequent removal to a rural rehab center far west of St. Louis, Regina Clary had not received a single complaint from the police or the daycare center about Father Graham, or for that matter, about any of the other five alleged offenders assigned there by the Archdiocese. Whether their past misdeeds or potential innocence in the case of at least one other accused priest besides Graham, none of them clearly qualified for the nastiest label applicable to a sex offender, as far as my retired friend knew. Forgive me, therefore, for mimicking Snap's careless use of terminology here. Two of those, quote-unquote, dangerous pedophiles it targeted at Regina Clary were men in their 80s. One was confined to a wheelchair, all of which made Snap's letter to Missouri's attorney general look like one more carefully contrived example of a worst-case scenario strategy. Put the contents of that letter alongside this terse message Snap began circulating widely in mid-November of 2006. Convicted, this is Snap talking, quote, convicted pedophile Father Graham was set free on a $500,000 bond paid by the St. Louis Archdiocese days ago, unquote. Despite the High Court's unanimous reversal on November 7th of the Graham conviction, Snap's convicted pedophile message continued prominently at the top of its Midwest website for 4 long months before it was finally removed in mid-March of 2007. It was not only one more cheap shot at Father Graham, who had never even been charged with pedophilia, it was also a telltale sign of Snap's brassy rejection of the legitimate authority of Missouri's highest court. For Catholics paying close attention, it was proof positive that Snap had lost any right to the uncritical adulation of the media. Maybe it's time for Snap and its leaders to take another look at all 10 of the commandments Moses brought down from the mountain centuries ago. Has Snap completely lost sight of the 8th commandment? When Moses warned his followers against bearing false witness against their neighbors, he was not just passing along a friendly word of advice to the Jewish people from local civil authorities. He was transmitting a divine mandate for every generation to come from that day forward. Now rest assured, says Goldkamp, nothing said here is meant to discredit the honest work of lawyers seeking to redress the old wrongs involving people inside or outside the church, but it would be incredibly naive, to say the least, to treat all Snap tort lawyers as knights in shining armor. Some have not exactly been guided by altruistic motives in claiming to act in their client's best interest. As a case in point, let's re-examine one of a limited number of damage suits involving true pedophiles, that of former priest Rudy Koss. I'm going to guess it's pronounced Koss. I've never heard anyone say it. Rudy Koss, in which a Dallas jury awarded $119 million to 11 former altar boys he had abused over a period of time. This was a particularly egregious case tied to the diocese's failure to remove Koss from active ministry sooner than it did. But do the math on that damage award. It would have broken down to nearly $11 million apiece for each plaintiff were it not for some generous lawyer's fees undoubtedly attached to it. With the diocese facing possible bankruptcy, the award was sharply reduced by a post-trial settlement to an amount still large enough to turn the plaintiffs into instant millionaires. How can that be construed as justice by the tens of thousands of Catholics in the Diocese of Dallas who had nothing to do with the clergy scandal, those now responsible, in other words, for much of the payoff for Koss's misdeeds? Fortunately, there are signs in at least a few locations that judges are tightening the rules for getting class action cases into court. One of them is Madison County, Illinois, just across the river from St. Louis. Before a new chief judge began steering its court system in a new direction, it was labeled by the American Tort Reform Association in Washington, D.C. as the nation's biggest judicial hellhole for 2004. So this is an area, court district, right across the river from St. Louis, called the judicial hellhole by the American Tort Reform. Tort is, you know, tort is a legal act under which you seek damages. And you'll hear people saying that we need tort reform because of all these ridiculous cases like the one of the spilled hot coffee and the huge judgment. And the tort lawyers are some of the biggest supporters of the left and the Jews and the Democratic Party. This area earned that reputation because of a big upsurge in class action suits that even included cases filed there by lawyers from distant states. A check by my own Belleville, Illinois paper showed that as a result of spiraling medical malpractice insurance costs, more than 150 doctors had left the region to resume their practices in a friendlier state. And this, again, is part of why healthcare costs so much, because the Jude court system allows people to sue and win inordinate amounts, thereby forcing doctors to pay much higher insurance rates, which they have to pass on to their customers. It's government involvement in healthcare that creates the problems, not government as the solution. Government goes into something, it causes problems, and then it presents itself as it uses those problems as the pretext for presenting itself as the solution, i.e. taking over the whole system rather than just simply a part. And you see that in the stories about Freddie and Fannie Mae. As these are presented to the public as though they're private organizations, just like the post office is presented to the public as though it's a private corporation. But in fact, they operate under special rules set by Congress, so they're not truly private organizations. And then when they fail or they need to be bailed out, the government appears as the knight in shining armor, and it will take it over and guarantee them. Well, that's the problem. It already guaranteed all of their loans, and that's the reason they're failing. Yet government is allowed by the media, which is no more than one of its own divisions at this point, to step in as the savior. And this fools people. They don't see that the government is the problem, not the solution. So this area is so bad that 150 doctors have actually left the region to start up practice somewhere else to try to get away from these crazy malpractice suits. Yet, if says Goldkamp, if a few jet-set lawyers for SNAP had come their way, court systems would become judicial hellholes for the Catholic community nationwide. While SNAP and some of its lawyers have tried hard to brush the problem aside, the risk of false accusations and fraudulent abuse claims is by no means unique to St. Louis. Quote, already in 2002 and early 2003, the prize-winning Boston Globe turned up false accusations against three priests in its own area. All three were later exonerated. Colorado Springs lawyer L. Martin Nussbaum, an expert on church-state legal issues, pointed out in America Magazine, that's a Catholic magazine, that a judicial panel review threw out some 60 questionable plaintiffs' claims in the Tucson, Arizona diocese bankruptcy proceeding, a proceeding brought about largely by sex abuse damage suits. Also, a Catholic group was formed in Detroit in 2002 to assist accused clergymen with their difficulties when church leaders took them out of service, sometimes based solely on the accuser's word, and left them on their own. A group, Opus Bono Sacerdoti, which means, I think in Latin, for the good works of the priests, operates its own website, www.opusbono, sacerdotal means priestly, is probably Latin or Italian for priest, sacerdotii.org. So this group opened that website to explore the problem elsewhere. After extensive contacts with priests across the country, Opus Bono now estimates there may be as many as several hundred innocent priests trapped by false accusations, or close to 20% of the total number accused are falsely accused. Its president, Joseph Maher, says false accusations against priests, quote, have gone up dramatically, unquote, in the past year or so. So after years of the Jew media playing up priests abusing kids and it becoming a joke and a staple of the culture, parallel to the way incestuous rednecks is a staple of Jew-controlled media humor, false accusations were on the rise against these priests. One can hardly deny, says Goldkamp, that SNAP members usually merited an empathetic response from others when they first brought their stories to public attention. But the people in the pews now paying most of the bills for clergy abuse have good reason to resist the biggest flaw in SNAP's public image today, its propensity to trash the reputation of nearly every accused priest in sight, with little apparent concern for whether he's truly guilty or not. For the most part, the bills being paid today for past clergy abuse are being covered not by the errant clergyman who perpetrated it, but by the people in the pews. But faithful Catholics across the country also have good reason to resist SNAP's lack of concern for whether an accused clergyman is truly guilty or not. Slandering an innocent man's reputation does nothing to heal old scars for real victims of sex abuse. It only opens up a new wound for an entirely different kind of victim. Maybe it's time for the media to wake up and recognize a dark new side to this ongoing story, the one that SNAP's leaders and lawyers do not want to leak out. And that's the end of that story, as related by Richard J. Goldkamp in Culture Wars, which you can find at culturewars.com, magazine edited by E. Michael Jones, and they have as their subtitle, or their guiding light, No Progress Outside the Moral Order. And I think the only thing missing from that article is really the what I supplied, which is the knowledge of the Jewish context that is the mass media, and the specifically Jewish reasons for, one, portraying the sex abuse scandal as larger than it is, and two, misrepresenting the nature of that scandal, not as one of homosexuality, which it is in Maine, but as pedophilia, which it is not. It is only pedophilia in a minority of the cases. And the Jews do that for the reason I indicated, which is that promoting homosexuality is high on their agenda because it promotes looseness among whites, it works against family formation, and it works against in favor of destroying families. And destroying white families, as what Edmund Burke, the father of modern conservatism, called the society's little platoons. Destroying families, or the little platoons of society, is the way that you wreck nations. And Jews have been known as nation wreckers for 2,000 years. The Romans called Jews the common enemy of humanity, and that indeed they are. And that's why we do this show, to point this out to you, because nobody else will point it out to you. And we come to you every Tuesday at 1 p.m. And our shows are archived and posted as MP3s you can download within 24 hours, thanks to our excellent archivist. And that was thing one we wanted to talk about today. Thing two will be a selection from The Nameless War. Why don't I play... I'm going to grab a little something to drink here, and I'm going to play... Let's see, what should I play? I'm going to play two or three songs, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about The Nameless War. I'm going to play Rick Springfield, and then Go-Go's, and then Sinking Ships, and then Trains I've Missed. So that will be a little four-song break here. It'll take about no more than 15 minutes. So here we go, and I'll be right back.
Here's to the trains I miss, the loves I lost, the bridges I burned, the rivers I never crossed. Here's to the call I didn't hear, the signs I didn't heed, the roads I couldn't take, the map that I just wouldn't read. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. It's to the trains I miss. I've been a clown, I've been a fool, and I pushed on every chance. I searched far and wide, trying to crawl out of God's hands. But there were stones I didn't throw, and hearts I didn't break, and a little hope I held on to with a silver shining thread of faith. It's a big old world, but I found my way from the hell and the hurt. Here's to the train I'm in. Here's to this place I found, love I know, the earth and the sky that I call home. And here's to the things I believe, bigger than me, and the moments I find myself right where I'm supposed to be. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. Yeah. It's a big old world, but I found my way, and the hell and the hurt led me straight to this. And here's to the trains I missed.
That was Trains I've Missed. I think that's Walt Williams. Sinking Ships by the Archibalds, Our Lips Are Sealed by the Go-Go's, and Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield, which you may remember from the 1980s. Now, after discussing the pedophilia, that is, homosexuality, let's discuss the Nameless War. This is by Captain A.H.M. Ramsey. And we've covered this on earlier Radio Astinas, at least a couple of the chapters out of it. Today I want to do chapters 3 to 5. And what this is a book by Captain Archibald Maule Ramsey, who was educated at Eton and the Royal Military College at Sandhurst, and a guy who served in the First World War and was actually wounded. This is a book by Ramsey, and he was actually thrown in jail during World War II because he was telling the truth about Jews and how they were trying to get Britain and the other white countries into a world war. And what he has done is go through some of the different revolutions. The English Revolution, a lot of people forget about that. So-called Glorious or Bloodless Revolution, in which the Jews installed a traitor on the throne, Jewish money, and he goes from that to the French Revolution, 1789, to the Russian Revolution, which was really the Judeo-Bolshevist Revolution of 1917 and beyond. And what he shows are the commonalities there, the similarities, the Jews operating behind the scenes, creating bands of terrorists and putting up their money to finance the overthrow and destruction of these white countries. So Ramsey is the oddest of creatures. He's a British loyalist. He's loyal to Britain. He's loyal to the white race. And for that, he was, it says, arrested under Regulation 18B on the 23rd of May, 1940, detained without charge or trial until the 26th of September, 1944. So kind of preventive detention. They didn't want him telling the truth. And there was a similar thing in the U.S., where even though 90% of the public was against our getting involved in the war, some of the top people speaking out against the war were thrown in jail because the Jews wanted war. And it's only under white law that you get to face your accuser and they have to produce evidence showing that you're guilty. When Jews control things, anything goes. They can do whatever they want extrajudicially, wherever they feel like it. Excuse me a second. Okay, so we, as I said, we have discussed this on Radio Astina before, last fall, I believe, and I'm not sure where we left off, but what we're going to do today is we're going to pick up the book with the Russian Revolution, and then he goes into, and that's chapter 3. Chapter 4 is Development of Revolutionary Technique. And then chapter 5, Germany Bells the Cat, and we'll read through these. They're very short little chapters, and just discuss them along the way. But and what this is a very, as I said, what you have to understand is the greater sweep of European history, and that's laid out by E. Michael Jones and his The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, which we've been referring to and discussing the last few shows. Along with other articles from his magazine, but the basic idea here is that there's a Catholic social order, and as the Protestants break off because the Jews are opposed to it, the Jews are blind people because they did not accept Christ as the king, and so the church regards them as blind. They regard the church as credulous, superstitious fools, and the two sides are doing war, and you know, the Jews try to rebuild the temple in 70 AD, and that fails due to natural or supernatural causes. And from then on, that's what formed the Jews as rejecting Christ, is what Jones says, as opposed to any biological view of what they are. So the church's position is that Jews can be converted to Catholicism. But Christianity kind of forms and congeals, as does Judaism, and around the time that Rome falls. For the next 1,000 years, there's a fair amount of order, and the Jews are locked away in their little ghettos and their shtetls and their little pales of settlement. And outside them, the Christian Europe develops, with the Catholic Church leading the way. But then, as the 1400s come, or even earlier, I mean, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, slowly the Jews begin to It's very back and forth. The church tries to convert them, and a couple of apostate Jews come over to the church and tell them what Jews really think about them, as written in the recorded in the Talmud. And the church comes to say that the Jews are very, very invidious, and it formulates the Judaizaikatnan, or Jews must be left alone and not forced to convert as long as they aren't undermining the Christian culture. And so, essentially, from about 800 to 1200 on to the modern day, there's just running battles as Jews try to subvert, and they use whatever tools they have, whether it's Protestants, Freemasons, Illuminati, whatever. They're all working to push a different conception of the world. And what Jones really shows in the chapters I've been reading lately, in the middle part of his book, is how so much of Protestantism and Freemasonry are based on Gentiles trying to discover the tricks of the Kabbalah, just like their Madonna or something. They're trying to ferret out this special occult wisdom and set up these lodges to further, you know, brotherhood, fraternity, and all this stuff claimed at the time of the French Revolution. And this side is opposed to the traditional Catholics. The Catholics form the Counter-Reformation. And the two areas are trying to steal people away from each other. Essentially, in England, you have, for personal reasons, Henry VIII steals all the church's lands and becomes a Protestant because he wants to do something immoral in the eyes of the church. And the new elite that arises, that has its wealth from these stolen church lands, brings over a new rule. I believe that was Charles I. I might be wrong about that, but the key is that while the church would like to see a restoration of the church in England, the Protestants, working with the Jews, the Freemasons, what have you, don't want to see that. And so you've got running battles with the Catholics down in Spain. The Catholics control Spain. The Protestants in England are doing battle with the Catholics, and you have the Inquisition in Spain, and that's actually run by an apostate Jew who's a converted Catholic. And they force the Jews to either convert or they drive them out. Where do they go? They go to the Netherlands. Netherlands, and think about where it's positioned between Britain you go from Britain over to the Netherlands, and then you're onto the continent. So the safe places for the Protestants are basically parts of Switzerland and principalities in Germany and the Netherlands and England. And arrayed against this are the traditionalists in France, in Spain, and Germany. And all of these forces are doing battle and trying to push things in their own direction. Now, Ramsay, we'll talk about Ramsay writes very short chapters detailing each of these revolutions and the role that the Jews had in them, so you understand what's actually going on here. But he doesn't, he gives you more of the political angle on it than the religious angle that you get, the religious fleshing out that you get from Jones. What Jones is saying is all these, they call them Judaizers or Judaizing Protestants. And what they want to do, all these revolutionaries, is claim that they are the new Israel. And this means going to the Old Testament instead of the New and finding a model in the Old Testament and calling themselves a modern-day example of, you know, Jeremiah or Nehemiah or somebody, or Moses, and this leads to all kinds of wacky behavior as they abandon the traditional social order and become these revolutionaries, both political and sexual. And they're literally dancing around naked and just acting crazy because they're claiming that they're a retreat to the original Christians. So these guys, in conjunction with the Freemasons and the Protestants, are aided by the Jews, who are copying the modern Bibles, that is, translated Bibles out of Greek and Latin, translating them into the local languages and querying the translations as they would later with the Scofield Bible, in order to put a Jew positive spin into it. So all this is known as, you know, the Enlightenment, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, as these struggles are going on to maintain either the traditional church view that we are the legitimate church, the one true church, the other churches are false, we will interpret Scripture, not the layman. And the Jews are using whatever they can of people like Luther, at least originally, and Calvin and some of the other Protestants who are noting the abuses of the church, and instead of trying to reform them, are breaking away and allying with the state. And this takes a number of different forms. But the Jews try to push this along however they can, and part of the way they do that is by the Jews who fled Spain and the Inquisition are up in Amsterdam. They have a lot of money, and they use that money to put their own people on the throne in England in the Glorious Revolution, and also to publish all of these different Bibles in the various different languages, and the Bibles are queered in translation. And this aids the Jewish cause. So this is kind of, Europe struggles through this for several hundred years. A battle between the Catholics who are forming the Counter-Reformation to try to form up lands that might be tempted to break away and join kind of the Dutch-English order. And as Ramsay says of the French Revolution, the revolution was not the work of Frenchmen to improve France. It was the work of aliens whose object was to destroy everything which had been France, destroy the king, destroy the church, replace it with these radicals and these crazies, some of whom are Jews, some of whom are not. But we're going to deal with the Russian Revolution today, and we'll just read chapters 3, 4, and 5 and make comments along the way. And that will be our show. And this is Radio Astina number 25. We do it every Tuesday. As I said, it's archived on MP3 within 24 hours. You can pass those around to your friend. All of the archives are at both govnn.com and vnnforum.com in our broadcasting section there. All right, Chapter 3, The Russian Revolution by Ramsay. And let's see, I'm trying to find what year this book was written in. It's the Nameless War. And what I've got is a reprint, and I don't... I'm going to guess he wrote this in, like, 1950. Or at least it was reprinted. The dedication is to the memory of those patriots who in 1215 at Runnymede signed the Magna Carta, and those who in 1320 at Arbroath signed the Declaration of Independence. This book is dedicated. 27 July 1952, so. And the key here is that Jews like to operate behind the scenes, hence it makes sense to call the war they've been engaged in against traditional white culture and morals as the Nameless War, is his designation. And the faceplate says, here's the story that people have said would never be written in our time. The true history of events leading up to the Second World War, told by one who enjoyed the friendship and confidence of Mr. Neville Chamberlain during the critical months between Munich and September 1939. There has long been an unofficial ban on books dealing with what Captain Ramsay calls the Nameless War, the conflict which has been waged from behind the political scene for centuries, which still is being waged and of which very few are aware. The publishers of the Nameless War believe this latest exposure will do more than any previous attempt to break the conspiracy of silence. The present work, with much additional evidence and a fuller historical background, is the outcome of the personal experiences of a public figure who, in the course of duty, has discovered at first hand the existence of a centuries-old conspiracy against Britain, Europe, and the whole of Christendom. The Nameless War reveals an unsuspected link between all the major revolutions in Europe, from King Charles I's time, that's the guy that the Jewish money put on the throne, so that he would let the Jews back into Britain from which they'd been expelled in 1290. And to the abortive attempt against Spain in 1936 when the Jewish communists tried to overthrow the country. One source of inspiration, design, and supply is shown to be common to all of them, and that would be the Jews. The revolutions in the World War of 1939 are seen to be integral parts of one and the same master plan. After a brief review of the forces behind the declaration of war and the worldwide arrests of many who endeavored to oppose them, the author describes the anatomy of the revolutionary international machine, the machine which today continues the plan for supranational supra, that is bigger than nation, supranational world power, the age-old messianic dream of international Jewry, which is them installed as kings of the world and everyone else reduced to the status of slaves, coffee-colored slaves due to the race mixing, as the Jews break down their altar and push the people out of their own lands. That's their religious goal. It is the author's belief that the machine would break down without the support of its unwilling Jews and unsuspecting Gentiles, and he puts forward suggestions for detaching these elements. So, let's see what he has to say about the Russian Revolution, which is his chapter 3. After chapter 1 is the English War, and chapter 2 is the French Revolution. We've covered those in earlier Radio Astinas. I'm not sure which ones, but I believe they were last year. We have each Radio Astina is numbered. This is number 25, which you're listening to today. Okay, and Captain A.H.M. Ramsey is the author here, The Nameless War, Chapter 3, The Russian Revolution. Monsieur François Coty, C-O-T-Y, the celebrated scent manufacturer, wrote in Figaro, it's a French paper, on 20th February 1932, "The subsidies granted to the nihilists at this period, 1905 to 1917, by Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb and Company, New York, were no longer acts of isolated generosity. A veritable Russian terrorist organization had been set up at his expense. It covered Russia with its emissaries." And again, that's Francis Coty writing in Figaro in 1932. And Jacob Schiff is a Jew of a financial house in New York who later admitted that he had paid $20 million in this time to subsidize the Russian Revolution carried out by Lenin and his gang of Jews. "The creation of terrorist formations by Jews within a country marked down for revolution, whether they be called nihilists, that is communist, or as in France in 1789, quote-unquote, sacred bands, or Marseillais, or operatives, as in the Britain of Charles I, now stands revealed as a standard technique." So the Jews pay to assemble these mobs of revolutionaries that they use to overthrow a country marked down for it, whether it's England with Cromwell, or it's France with the king, or it's the U.S. or Russia. Jacob Schiff also financed Japan in her war against Russia in 1904-1905, as we learn from the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is supposedly the first time in history that a white nation lost to a non-white nation. So Schiff not only funded the Judeo-Bolshevist Revolution in Russia, he funded the Japanese war against Russia in 1904, 10 or 12 years before. This war was immediately followed by an attempt at revolution on a considerable scale in Russia, which, however, proved abortive. So they didn't succeed in 1904-1905 by subsidizing Russia's external enemies and her internal enemies, but they kept trying. The next attempt during the Great War met with complete success. That is, during World War I, the Russian Revolution was able to succeed shortly thereafter. On the 3rd of January 1906, the Russian foreign minister supplied to Emperor Nicholas II a report on this revolutionary outbreak, which, as revealed in the American Hebrew of July 13, 1918, so around the end of the World War I, American Hebrew is saying, contain the following passages, quote, "The events which took place in Russia in 1905 plainly indicate that the revolutionary movement has a definite international character. The revolutionaries possess great quantities of arms imported from abroad and very considerable financial means. One is bound to conclude that there are foreign capitalist organizations interested in supporting our revolutionary movement. That is, Jews from New York are shipping arms and shipping money to their fellow Jewish revolutionaries in Russia, some of whom actually themselves come from America. So they not only sent arms and money, they sent the actual radicals themselves from America to Russia, Lower East Side of New York. And I believe that either Kevin MacDonald or E. Michael Jones has documented somewhere that as soon as Jews began coming to the U.S. around 1880, 1890, in any appreciable numbers from Eastern Europe, they petitioned for an exclusion from some act barring trade with Russia so that they would be allowed to do specifically this while whining about pogroms, which was the natural reaction to their revolutionary behavior. They would be able legally to sell arms and to provide munitions and guns to their radical cohort over in Russia. They petitioned the U.S. Congress to pass that, and I believe it did. I think that was in 1880 to 1900. Going on with what the American Hebrew says, Jewish paper says, or Jewish magazine says, if we add to above that, as has been proved beyond doubt, a very considerable part is played by Jews, as ringleaders in other organizations as well as their own, always the most bellicose element of the revolution, we may feel entitled to assume that the above-mentioned foreign support of the Russian revolutionary movement comes from Jewish capitalist circles. Oh, I thought communism and capitalism were different things. No, the capitalist Jews fund the scum, the lower class scum, communist Jews, to take over Russia, because what matters is the Jewish aspect of it, not aspect, soul of it. Communist, capitalist are just terms to confuse the outsider, the stupid goy who's looking on and suffering all this. The assumption in the foregoing report was indeed well justified, says Ramsey. It was to be confirmed by an even more important official document penned at the height of the revolution itself in 1918 by Mr. Oudendyk, representative of the Netherlands in St. Petersburg, who was in charge of British interests in Russia after the liquidation of our embassy by the Bolsheviks. So important indeed was this report by Mr. Oudendyk, held to be by Mr. Balfour, that's the guy who guaranteed Zion to the Jews in exchange for bringing about American participation in World War I. So important indeed was this report of Mr. Oudendyk's held to be by Mr. Balfour, to whom it was addressed, that it was set out in a British government white paper on Bolshevism issued in April 1919. So here we have at the end of the First World War, and the Russians have taken control, or the Jewish revolutionaries, the Jewish Bolsheviks have taken control of Russia, and we have foreign diplomats in the Western countries who are reporting the state of affairs, documenting it, and we have actual confirmation by the Jews themselves in their own internal publications. Now, what the Dutch diplomat says is, quote, I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war in which is still raging, World War I, that would be. And unless Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. The Jews' one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. So the Dutch diplomat is saying the same thing E. Michael Jones does. He's not looking at it from the spiritual point of view. He's saying, look, the Russian Revolution, now successfully completed in Russia, they formed a peace treaty with Germany near the end of World War. I think that was Brest-Litovsk, near the end of World War I, giving Lenin a free hand in Russia and the Germans a chance to turn their attentions to the West, where they're battling France, the U.S., and Britain. And this Dutch diplomat is saying it's the most important thing in the world, even more important than an ongoing world war, that we destroy this Bolshevism before it destroys us. But we didn't destroy it, and now it is destroying us. A still clearer light is thrown on these happenings by the article, by an article written on 12 April 1919 in a paper called The Communist at Kharkov by one M. Cohen, who says, quote, the great Russian Revolution was indeed accomplished by the hands of Jews. There are no Jews in the ranks of the Red Army as far as privates are concerned, but in the committees and in the Soviet organization as commissars, that is, political police, the Jews are gallantly leading the masses. The symbol of Jewry has become the symbol of the Russian proletariat, which can be seen in the fact of the adoption of the five-pointed star, which in former times was the symbol of Zionism and Jewry. So you've got a Jew, M. Cohen,
same time as the Dutch diplomat, same time as the Jewish paper in America, the American Hebrew, admitting that Jews are the leaders of the so-called Russian Revolution. Dr. Fahey, in his important and authenticated work, The Rulers of Russia, is more specific, stating that in 1917, of the 52 persons who took over the direction in Russia, all but Lenin were Jews. All but Lenin were Jews, and Lenin's believed to be at least a quarter Jew through his grandmother. So thorough was the mass liquidation of all but hewers of wood and drawers of water, white niggers, in Russia, that this Jewish grip remained unaltered. Dr. Fahey tells us that in 1935, the central executive of the Third International, which ruled Russia, consisted of 59 men, of which 56 were Jews. The other three, including Stalin, were married to Jewesses. Of 17 principal Soviet ambassadors, 14 were Jews. So it's a totally Jewish revolution that was carried out in Russia. The Reverend George Simons, who was superintendent of the Methodist Episcopal Church in St. Petersburg from 1907 to October 1918, appeared before a committee of the United States Senate on the 12th of February 1919 and gave a report of his personal knowledge of the happenings in Russia up to the time he left. Dr. Fahey quotes him as saying, during this evidence, quote, in December 1918, out of 388 members of the revolutionary government, only 16 were real Russians. All the rest were Jews, with the exception of one U.S. Negro. I wonder if that was Claude McKay that's mentioned by Jones, because we talked about the Scottsboro Boys last show, and that was the big trial in the U.S. in the 30s. And we saw how the communists were attempting to turn the Negroes into revolutionaries in the U.S. Listen to Radio Astina number 24 if you want to hear that whole story as taken by Jones. And so what we have here is, out of 388 members of the revolutionary government, only 16 are real Russians, the rest are Jews, and 265 of these Jews come from the Lower East Side of New York. So the so-called Russian Revolution is really a Jewish revolution, funded by Jews, carried out by Jews, and the murderers and the political police are Jews. And they've decapitated Russia by killing all the intelligent white people. Such has been the condition of affairs in the USSR from that day to this, when he's writing this in 1952. Though a number of Jews were liquidated in the so-called Moscow Purge, this affected the situation in no way. It merely signified that one Jewish faction had triumphed over another, triumphed over and liquidated another. There has never been anything in the nature of a Gentile revolt against the Jewish domination of Russia, says Ramsey. So you like how he's condensed the Russian Revolution into very few words. It was a Jewish affair from conception to execution. Ramsey says, the fact that some Jews were liquidated by winning factions behind the Iron Curtain could be used to deceive the world outside into thinking that this was the result of an anti-Semitic revolt. And from time to time, a hoax of this kind has been systematically propaganded. He says propaganded rather than propagated. And that's true. We hear even today, oh, Stalin and the USSR are anti-Semitic, and special laws were passed in the U.S., granting special privileges to Jews who came over here from the Soviet Union. As world opinion gradually turned hostile to the USSR, important Jews began to fear that this feeling, combined with a gradual realization that Bolshevism is Jewish, might have unpleasant reactions for them. About 1945, therefore, a further powerful campaign was organized from influential Jewish circles, notably in the USA, to put out the story once again that Russia had turned on the Jews. They evidently failed, however, to advise their lesser brethren of this move, and indignant and informed denials were soon forthcoming. A journal called Bulletin, the organ of the Glasgow Discussion Group, wrote in June 1945, quote, such rubbish as is now being spread to the growth of anti-Semitism in Russia is nothing but malicious lies and pure invention. So, communists in other countries are not realizing that this is a propaganda put out by Jews in the USSR to make it appear that they're the victims rather than the perpetrators of communism, and some of the communists in other countries aren't catching on quick enough not to write stuff in their paper revealing the truth, which is that Judaism, as Rabbi Stephen Wise, the top rabbi of the U.S. the first 50 years of the 20th century, said, you know, communism is Judaism. Some call it communism, I call it Judaism. Today's Rabbi Wise might say some call it multiculturalism, I call it Judaism. On 1st February 1949, the Daily Worker carried an article in which a Mr. Parker gave a few names and figures of Jews in high offices in the USSR, from which he had evidently recently returned, for he wrote, quote, "I never heard a breath of criticism over this state of affairs," unquote, and stated later in the same article, quote, "Anti-Semitism would render a Soviet official liable to prosecution in the same way that a private citizen may be brought before the courts for anti-Semitism." And like many have said, the Jews' first act upon taking power through the communist revolution they effected in Russia was to outlaw anti-Semitism and make it a capital crime. On the 10th of November 1949, the Daily Worker, that constant and burning champion of the Jews, printed an article by Mr. D. Cartoon, K-A-R-T-U-N, entitled "Stamping Out Anti-Semitism," which shows the complete Jewish control behind the Iron Curtain when he writes, quote, "In Poland and other people's democracies, anti-Semitism in word or deed is most heavily punished," unquote. So that was written in the Daily Worker in 1949, in the period in which they're claiming that the Jews were the victims of Stalin and the victims of anti-Semitism, when in fact they were the perpetrators and they persecuted anyone who criticized them after denouncing him as an anti-Semite. Between 1945 and 1949, the propaganda to convince Gentiles outside the Iron Curtain that within that area anti-Semitism was rampant and the Jews driven from high office everywhere was energetically pursued. So after World War II, they began to spread this lie that Jews are the victims of communism rather than the perpetrators of it and the rulers of it. It began to be believed by quite a number of people who should have known better, so much so that in the autumn of the latter year, 1949, I thought it worthwhile to get out a list showing the number of vital positions held by Jews behind the Iron Curtain. Here is an extract from those lists. He says, Premier Stalin married to a Jew. Vice Premier Kaganovich is a Jew. Ministry of Strait Control, Mekhlis, M-E-K-H-L-I-S, is a Jew. Military and Naval Construction is Ginsburg, who is a Jew. Minister of Common Form, Organ, Yudin, Y-U-D-I-N, is a Jew. Chief Publicist Abroad for the USSR, Ilya Ehrenberg, is a Jew. He's one of the guys, or the guy, who thought up the lie of the 6 million Jews killed in World War II in the Holocaust, although that number has magical connotations and magical meaning within Kabbalah. That's why they choose the 6 and the 6 million. But Ilya Ehrenberg was mainly responsible for promoting that as the number of Jews killed in World War II by the Nazis. Ministry of Building Enterprises, Machinery, Yudin, a Jew, another Jew named Yudin. Foreign Minister Molotov, married to a Jewess. Virtual Ruler Jacob Bergman is a Jew. Public Prosecutor T. Cyprian is a Jew. OC Youth Movements, Dr. Braniewski is a Jew. Hungary's Virtual Ruler Matthias Rakosi is a Jew. Romania's Virtual Ruler Anna Pauker is a Jewess, since removed for deviationism but replaced by another Jew. Yugoslavia's virtual ruler is Moishe Pajeda, or Pieda, P-Y-J-E-D-E, is a Jew. In May, so that's a list of all the some of the heavies who were Jewish in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union after World War II. In May 1949, the Daily Worker, which is, of course, consistently and ardently pro-Jewish, printed an article by Mr. A. Rothstein praising the USSR to the skies. And about the same time, another article on similar lines about the paradise behind the Iron Curtain by Mr. Sam Aronovich, or Sam Aronovich. Now, Daily Worker is the U.S. communist paper, printing articles by Jews in a Jewish paper celebrating Jews and the Jewish paradise that is the Soviet Union. And these articles appear in 1949, after 5 years of the Jews spreading the lie that they are the victims of of the Soviet Union that they alone created. On the 10th of November, the same paper printed an article in which Dr. Khartoum, writing of the people's democracies and the stamping out of anti-Semitism there, wrote, quote, "No one could dream of making an anti-Semitic speech or writing an anti-Semitic article in any of these countries. If they did, their jail sentence would be both immediate and lengthy." And that, I guess, appeared in the American Daily Worker communist paper. In the last few years, we have been supplied with further dramatic proof of the vital interrelation between Jews and the USSR, from the Canadian spy trials, which focused on the spotlight on Adam spying for the USSR, with the conviction and imprisonment of Frank Rosenberg, alias Rose, the Canadian Jew Communist Member of Parliament, and several Jews, to the conviction and imprisonment of many of the same gang in Britain and the USA, including Fuchs, Professor Weinbaum, Judith Kaplan, Harry Gold, David Greenglass, Julius Rosenberg, Miriam Moskowitz, Abraham Brothantz, and Raymond Boyer, who, though a Gentile by birth, married a Jewess and, I believe, adopted the Jewish creed on that occasion. So those are all a good number of Jews who are convicted or investigated for giving atomic secrets to the Soviet Union, that paradise for Jews. The Jews were at the time misrepresenting as a hell for Jews. No doubt we shall continue to be regaled with plausible stories proving that Russia has gone anti-Semitic, says Ramsey, but it is not hard to realize that such a Jewish grip, backed by the most elaborate spy and liquidation squads known to man, would cause a convulsion which would shake the world before its grip could be broken. He's saying, you know, if there ever comes a day when the Jews aren't running the USSR, believe me, you'll know it, because the world will be in convulsions rather than the Jews yield their grip over the most powerful spying and murder machine known to history. And that, my friends, is the truth. And that, in very few short pages, is a summing up of the Judeo-Bolshevist monster known as USSR. Now, we'll move on to Chapter 4. We're going to cover Chapter 4 and Chapter 5. Chapter 4 is the development of revolutionary technique. So unlike the other chapters, which cover the English, Chapter 1, then the French, Chapter 2, then the Russian revolutions, this chapter is about revolutionary technique. And it's just a few pages. And Captain A.H.M. Ramsey says, "Four revolutions in history merit our special attention. The study and comparison of the methods employed therein will reveal, on the one hand, a basic similarity between them, and on the other hand, an interesting advance in technique with each succeeding upheaval. It is as if we studied the various stages in the evolution of the modern rifle from the old original Brown Bess. The revolutions in question are firstly the Cromwellian, that is the English, secondly the French, thirdly the Russian, and lastly the Spanish Revolution of 1936, again preceding World War II. All four can be proved to have been the work of international Jewry. The first three succeeded and secured the murder of the reigning monarch and the liquidation of his supporters." So that is, they killed the English king, they killed the French king, they killed the Russian Tsar, and they tried to do it in Spain. The murder of the reigning monarch and the liquidation, that means the murder, the killing, the execution of his supporters. In each case, Jewish finance and underground intrigue are clearly traceable, and the earliest measures passed by the revolutionaries have been emancipation for the Jews. So the Jews, with their money and their murder machine, come to power, and then they emancipate the Jews legally, and legally privilege them over the Goyim, who are thrown in jail if they speak anti-Semitically, let alone act. Cromwell was financed by various Jews, notably Manasseh ben Israel and Carvajal, the great Jew, contractor to his army. And these are Jews. Jones goes into this in greater detail. A rifle from the old original Brown Bess. The revolutions in question are firstly the Cromwellian, that is the English, secondly the French, thirdly the Russian, and lastly the Spanish Revolution of 1936, again preceding World War II. All four can be proved to have been the work of international Jewry. The first three succeeded and secured the murder of the reigning monarch and the liquidation of his supporters. So that is, they killed the English king, they killed the French king, they killed the Russian Tsar, and they tried to do it in Spain. The murder of the reigning monarch and the liquidation, that means the murder, the killing, the execution of his supporters. In each case, Jewish finance and underground intrigue are clearly traceable, and the earliest measures passed by the revolutionaries have been emancipation for the Jews. So the Jews, with their money and their murder machine, come to power, and then they emancipate the Jews legally, and legally privilege them over the Goyim, who are thrown in jail if they speak anti-Semitically, let alone act. Cromwell was financed by various Jews, notably Manasseh ben Israel and Carvajal, the great Jew, contractor to his army. And these are Jews. Jones goes into this in greater detail. They're seeing themselves as revolutionaries. We're going to restore the true church. They identify themselves with Jewish figures in the Old Testament, and they try to effect revolutions. We are the real Jews, and they're thrilled by the idea of bringing true Jews over into England so they can look at them up close and see what they're like, have something to model themselves on. At least for a while they felt that way. It really is a kind of a version of today's what is known as Christian identity. We are the real Jews, and relating yourself to the old tribes and the goings on in the Old Testament. So Ramsey says that the Cromwellians, the English revolutionaries, were soaked in Old Testament Judaism. Some, such as General Harrison, even carried their Judaism to the length of advocating the adoption of the Mosaic Law as the law of England, and the substitution of Saturday as the Sabbath in place of the Christian Sunday. And again, Jones goes into this stuff at great length. We are all familiar with absurd Old Testament passages which the Roundhead rank and file adopted as names, such as Surgeon Obadiah. Bind their kings in chains and their nobles in fetters of iron. So you basically have scum, uneducated, and it just seems to have a great hold on people's mind, the Bible, for some reason. And so they have to cast themselves as the heroes. And try to bring about all these wonderful things that they find in the Old Testament. It's ridiculous, but it happens over and over and over. It's not just in England. It happened in Germany at the Anabaptists, Thomas Münzer, and then the city of Münster going nuts, following people. The Cromwellian Revolution, says Ramsey, was short-lived. The work of destruction had not been sufficiently thorough to frustrate counter-revolution and restoration of the old regime. Well, actually, the Jews backed the new regime after Cromwell fell out of power. A second revolution, the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1689, was necessary. This again was financed by Jews, notably Solomon Medina, Suaso, Moses Machado, and others. And these are Jews who are probably, their ancestors were kicked out of Spain in the 1490s, 200 years earlier. They're forced to convert or kicked out of Spain. They go to the Netherlands. They build, they get rich there, and they publish political material, and they try to get themselves back into England, or into England. By the French Revolution of 1789, so another 100 years later, the technique had been notably improved. Secret societies had been developed throughout France on a grand scale in the preceding years. The plans for the liquidation of the former regime are by this time far more drastic. The judicial murder of a kindly and well-intentioned king and a few nobles is replaced by mass murders in prisons and in private houses of the whole of the nobility, clergy, gentry, and bourgeoisie, regardless of sex. Basically, they're going to kill off the native upper classes and replace them with a Jewish head, Jewish radical head. The Cromwellian damage and desecration of a few churches by their temporary use as stables is developed into a general wrecking of Christian churches, or their conversion into public lavatories, brothels, and markets, and the banning of the practice of the Christian religion and even the ringing of church bells. And so these are attacks carried out upon the true church, or the Catholic Church, by these Jews who hate the Catholic Church. And the Jews are the leaders of the revolutionaries, and they may work in tandem with the Protestants or the Freemasons, and later the Illuminati. The Illuminati didn't exist until 1776. And so we see, even in the French Revolution, the takeover of the Christian churches and their destruction, as we would see later in the Soviet Union as well. Civil war is not allowed to develop. The army is sidetracked and kept apart from its king by his seizure at an early stage. So powerful is the unseen control by 1789 that apparently the dregs of the French population victoriously liquidate all their natural leaders, in itself a most unnatural and suspicious phenomenon, says Ramsey. More suspicious still is the sudden appearance of strong bands of armed hooligans who march on Paris from Lyon and Marseille, and who are recorded as being obviously foreigners. Here we have the first formations of alien mercenary and criminal elements forcing revolutions upon a country not their own, which were to have their finished and expanded prototype in the international brigades which attempted to force Marxism on Spain 150 years later. So, ultimately, they're going to get back at being kicked out of Spain, even though they were treacherous and helped admit the Moors, the Arabs back then. They're going to get back at them, 400 years later in the 1900s. England in the 17th century, the 1600s, had not been dismembered and hideously remolded on alien lines. But all familiar landmarks in the 18th century France were destroyed. The splendid and historic names and titles of counties, departments, and families were scrapped, and France divided into numbered squares occupied merely by citizens. This was the equality aspect. Even the months of the calendar were changed. The national flag of France, with its lilies and its glories, was banned. Instead, the French received the tricolore, the badge of murder and rapine. Here, however, the planners made a mistake. The tricolore might not be the honored and famous flag of France. It might be dripping with the blood of massacre, regicide, and villainy. It might be stinking with the slime of the Jewish criminals who designed and foisted it upon the French people. But it was proclaimed the national flag, and the national flag it became. And with the national flag came the national army and a great national leader, Napoleon. It was not long before this great Frenchman ran up against the secret powers, who up till then controlled the armies of France. They had planned to use these armies to revolutionize all European states one after another, to overthrow all leadership and establish the rule of the mob, apparently in reality, of course, their own. So he's saying the Jews are masquerading as the mob of lower-class Frenchmen rising up to decapitate the nation, giving it new symbols and new names. Just in this manner do the Jews today plan to use the Red Army. Such a policy directed by aliens of this type could not long continue once a national army had thrown up a real national leader. It's more complex than he lets on. Jones goes into a great deal of Napoleon trying to proclaim himself as a Jesus type, and to be worshipped as the Messiah by Jews in exchange for granting them legal equality. Jones has much more on that, whereas Ramses is a thumbnail. So, just in this manner do the Jews today plan to use the Red Army. Such a policy directed by aliens of this type could not long continue once a national army had thrown up a real national leader. Their outlook and policy must inevitably be poles apart. It was not long before the first consul changed and overthrew these aliens and their puppets. By the year 1804, Napoleon had come to recognize the Jew and his plans as a menace to France, and all that revolution had swept away he systematically restored. From this time onwards, Jewish money financed every coalition against him, and the Jews today boast that it was Rothschild, rather than Wellington, who defeated Napoleon. Knowing these things, Hitler, on his occupation of Paris, immediately ordered a permanent guard of honor to be mounted over Napoleon's tomb at the Invalides, and had the body of L'Aiglon, Napoleon's son by Maria Louisa, brought from Austria and buried at last in his proper place at the side of his father. When we come to examine the Russian Revolution, we find that the technique is still bolder and far more dramatic. On this occasion, no national flag, army, or anthem is permitted. after the dregs of the community have apparently accomplished the impossible and liquidated every other class down to and including the kulak, a man with three cows. That is a rich peasant, as the communists call him. They are herded into a polyglot force called the Red Army. Over them waves an international red flag, not a Russian flag. Their anthem is the Internationale. So the Jews always intended this revolution to be global. They didn't want it to take on a Russian national character because that would necessarily be pulled apart from their intention. The technique of revolution in Russia was so perfected that to this day it has secured the Jewish regime against... It was so perfected in Russia that to this day the technique of revolution has secured the Jewish regime established there against all counterstrokes. He's writing this in 1952. The next revolution to merit our attention is the one that broke out in Spain in 1936. Fortunately for all Europe, so they're trying to kind of bookend Russia. They've achieved a revolution in Russia. They're trying to foment revolution in Eastern Europe and in Germany after World War I, and they're also trying to do it in Spain, the other end of Europe. Fortunately for Europe, it was frustrated by General Franco and a number of gallant men who instantly took the field in opposition to the revolutionary forces and succeeded in a long struggle in crushing them. This achievement is all the more remarkable in view of the latest developments in revolutionary organization, which was then revealed in the shape of the International Brigades. These International Brigades, besides representing the very latest novelty in revolutionary technique, were a remarkable production. They are recruited from criminals, adventurers, and dupes, mostly communists, from 52 different countries, mysteriously transported and assembled in formations in Spain within a few weeks of the outbreak of disorder, uniformed in a garb closely related to our battle dress, and armed with weapons bearing the Jewish five-pointed star. This star and the seal of Solomon were upon the signet rings of the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, and the officers in this communist horde of ill-disciplined ruffians. I have seen them myself in Wear. And remember, there was a brigade, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, of U.S. Jews who went over to aid this communist revolution in Spain in 1936 that Franco crushed with the help of the Luftwaffe. By October 1936, these international brigades were already assembled in Spain in considerable numbers. Undisciplined and blackguardly though they were, the mere fact of a large and well-armed political army intervening suddenly on one side in the early stages of a civil war might reasonably have been counted upon to achieve a decision before the patriotic and decent element in the country could have time to create an adequate fighting machine. Though the British public were kept in total ignorance of the true significance of what was taking place in Spain, just as the U.S. today is lied to, two countries in Europe were alive to the situation. Germany and Italy had each in their turn experienced the throes of communist revolution and emerged victorious over this foulest of earthly plagues. They knew who had financed and organized the international brigades and with what fell purpose. Fell means violent. With what violent purpose Barcelona had been declared in October 1936 the capital of the Soviet states of Western Europe. At the critical moment, Germany and Italy intervened in just sufficient strength to counter the International Brigade and enable the Spanish people to organize their own army, which in due course easily settled the matter. Settled the matter, that is to say, as far as Spain was concerned. There was, however, another settlement to come. International Jewry had been seriously thwarted. They would not rest henceforward until they could have their revenge, until they could, by hook or crook, turn the guns of the rest of the world against these two states, which, in addition to thwarting their designs in Spain, were in the process of placing Europe upon a system independent of gold and usury. A system which, if permitted to develop, would break the Jewish power forever. And again, the Jewish power through all these long ages, the source of their financial power has been usury. And Germany has figured a way around that, the international monetary system. And so, Germany and Italy have not only gotten outside the system, or at least Germany has, outside the international economic system the Jews are using to enslave Christian lands, they have crushed the communist revolution within Spain, and the Jews have to destroy Germany and Italy to complete their worldwide global communist revolution. And that's the subject of chapter 5. Germany bells the cat. This will be our last chapter. A few pages here, and then we'll wrap it up for today. Ramsey says, Germany bells the cat, chapter 5. The urgent alarm sounded in 1918 by Mr. Oudendijk. That is when he's saying that the Dutch diplomat who's saying there's nothing more urgent than that we crush Bolshevism lest it unleash a worldwide revolution, a Jewish communist revolution. The urgent alarm sounded in 1918 by Mr. Oudendijk in his letter to Mr. Balfour, denouncing Bolshevism as a Jewish plan, which, if not checked by the combined action of the European powers, would engulf Europe and the world, was no exaggeration. By the end of that year, 1918, end of World War I, the red flag was being hoisted in most of the great cities of Europe. In Hungary, the Jew Bela Kun organized and maintained for some time a merciless and bloody tyranny similar to the one in Russia. In Germany, the Jews Liebknecht, Barth, Scheidermann, Rosa Luxemburg, etc., made a desperate bid for power. These and other similar convulsions shook Europe, but each country in its own way just frustrated the onslaughts. In most countries concerned, a few voices were raised in an endeavor to expose the true nature of these evils. Only in one, however, did a political leader and group arise who grasped to the full the significance of these happenings and perceived behind the mobs of native hooligans the organization and driving power of world Jewry. This leader was Adolf Hitler and his group, the National Socialist Party of Germany. Never before in history had any country not only repulsed organized revolution but discerned Jewry behind it and faced up to that fact. And that's what the English-speaking countries today can't do. They just don't have the quality of men needed to face up to the fact that Jews have taken over our countries. Only in Germany did they have someone who had that character. Probably because the people there were more educated and had a better character than they do in the Anglophone or Francophone countries. So, we need not wonder that the sewers of Jewish vituperation were flooded over these men and their leader, nor should we make the mistake of supposing that Jewry would stick in any lie to deter honest men everywhere from making a thorough investigation of the facts from themselves. That is, the Jews want to censor anybody who looks into the actual history of their despicable race and what it has done to whites. Nevertheless, if any value liberty, says Ramsey, and set out to seek truth and defend it, this duty of personal investigation is one which they cannot shirk. To accept unquestioningly the lies and misrepresentations of a Jew-controlled or influenced press is to spurn truth by sheer idleness, if for no worse reason. To act on such an unverified basis is to sin against the light. In the case of Germany and Hitler, the task of research is not difficult. We have it on many authorities that Hitler's book Mein Kampf stated fully and accurately the author's observations and conclusions concerning all these vital matters. Quite false pictures have been propagated deliberately about this book by quoting passages out of their context, distorting meanings, and downright misrepresentation. Having read many of these unscrupulous diatribes, it was with no little surprise that I read this book for myself not so very long ago. From many conversations I had heard and taken part in, I now realized that most members of the public were as ignorant as I of the real nature of this remarkable book. I propose, therefore, to try and give a true picture of its spirit and purport by quotations from its two main themes. Firstly, realization and exposure of the Jewish scheme for world Marxism, and secondly, admiration of and longing for friendship with Great Britain. Writing of the days before 1914, Hitler states, "I still saw Jewry as a religion. Of the existence of deliberate Jewish hostility I had no conception. I gradually realized that the social democratic press was preponderantly controlled by Jews. There was not a single paper with which Jews were connected which could be described as genuinely national. I seized all the social democratic pamphlets I could get a hold of and looked up the names of their authors, nothing but Jews." As he pursued the study of these questions, Hitler began to perceive the main outlines of the truth. Quote, "I made also a deep study of the relation between Judaism and Marxism. The Jewish state never had boundaries as far as space was concerned. It was unlimited as regards space, but bound down by its conception of itself as a race. That people, therefore, was always a state within a state. Even Jefferson said something like that. Jews are hostile and alien to the land they live among. The Jewish doctrine of Marxism rejects the aristocratic principle in nature, denies the value of the individual among men, combats the importance of nationality and race, thereby depriving humanity of the whole meaning of existence. Democracy, says Hitler, in the West today is the forerunner of Marxism, which would be inconceivable without democracy. If the Jew, with the help of his Marxian creed, conquers the nations of the world, his crown will be the funeral wreath of the human race. Unquote. Thus did I now believe, says Hitler, he writes of the days of 1918, that by defending myself against the Jews, I am doing the Lord's work. Unquote. At the end of 1918, there came the revolution in Germany, organized behind the unbroken army in the field. That is, the Germans accepted peace terms, but when they did, there weren't any foreign troops in Germany. They had won the war in the East with the Soviet Union. They had fought to a peace treaty, Brest-Litovsk, and then they were fighting in the West when they agreed to surrender. That's why he says, that's why Ramsay says, at the end of 1918, there came the revolution in Germany, organized behind the unbroken army in the field. So while the Germans are off fighting the war, the Jews are fomenting communist revolution back in Germany with the abdication of the Kaiser. Concerning this, Hitler wrote, in November, sailors arrived in lorries and called on us all to revolt, a few Jewish youths being the leaders in that struggle for the, quote, freedom, beauty, and dignity of our national life, unquote. Not one of them had ever been to the front. So this is the Dolchstoßlegende, the stabbed in the back, what the Jews call a myth or legend. You can decide for yourself whether it's a myth or whether it's true. The Germans were stabbed in the back by these Jews who were not fighting in the front, but were working in the offices behind the scenes to foment communist revolution. Says Hitler, the real organizer of the revolution and its actual wire puller, the international Jew. The revolution was not made by the forces of peace and order, but by those of riot, robbery, and plunder. That is Luxembourg, League Connect, and the rest. I was beginning to learn afresh, and only now, 1919, came to the right comprehension of the teachings and intentions of the Jew Karl Marx. Only now did I properly understand his Kapital book, and equally also the struggle of the social democracy against the economics of the nation, and that its aim is to prepare the ground for the domination of the truly international capital. Emperor to offer the hand of friendship to the leaders of Marxism. While they held the imperial dagger in theirs, the other hand was already feeling for... While they held the imperial hand in theirs, the other hand was already feeling for the dagger. With the Jew there is no bargaining. There is merely the hard either-or. Either they rule or you rule yourself. Later on, Hitler gives in great detail the outlines of the Jewish disruptive machine. By means of the trade unions, which might have been the saving of the nation, the Jew actually destroys the nation's economics. By creating a press which is on the intellectual level of the least educated, the political and labor organization obtains force of compulsion, enabling it to make the lowest strata of the nation ready for the most hazardous enterprises. Says Hitler, continuing, the Jewish press tears down all which may be regarded as a prop of a nation's independence, civilization, and its economic autonomy. It roars especially against characters who refuse to bow the knee to Jewish domination, or whose intellectual capacity appears to the Jew in the light of a menace to himself. So again, they're decapitating the nation. They're teaching it every bad way to go about destroying itself in order to further ensconce the Jews in power. The ignorance displayed by the mass and the lack of instinctive perception of our upper class make the people easy dupes of this campaign of Jewish lies. True for Germany then, true for Germany, for U.S. today. But the present day is working its own ruin. It introduces universal suffrage, chatters about equal rights, and can give no reason for so thinking. In its eyes, material rewards are the expression of a man's worth, thus shattering the basis for the noblest equality that could possibly exist. It is one of the tasks of our movement to hold out prospects of a time when the individual will be given what he needs in order to live, but also to maintain the principle that man does not live for material enjoyment alone. The political life of today alone has persistently turned its back on this principle of nature, i.e. quality. Human civilization is but the outcome of the creative force of personality in the community as a whole, and especially among its leaders. The principle of the dignity of the nation is beginning, the dignity of the majority, is beginning to poison all life below it, and in fact to break it up. We now see that Marxism is the enunciated form of the Jewish attempt to abolish the importance of personality in all departments of human life and set up the mass of numbers in its place. The principle of decision by majorities has not always governed the human race. On the contrary, it only appears during quite short periods of history, when those are always periods of decadence in nations and states. We must not forget that the international Jew, who continues to dominate over Russia, does not regard Germany as an ally, but as a state destined to undergo a similar fate, says Hitler. On the last page and in almost the last paragraph of Mein Kampf is the following. Quote, "The party as such stands for positive Christianity, but does not bind itself in the matter of creed to any particular confession. It combats the Jewish materialistic spirit within us and without us. Looking around the world for help in the battle against this terrible menace of Jew-directed Bolshevism, Hitler's mind constantly reverted to Britain and the British Empire," says Ramsey. "He always longed for their friendship, always declared Britain to be one of the greatest bulwarks against chaos, and that her interests and those of Germany were complementary and not contrary to one another. It was not a British interest," he wrote, "but in the first place a Jewish one to destroy Germany." So it wasn't in Britain's interest to destroy Germany, it was in the Jews' interest. And again, "Even in England there is a continual struggle going on between the representatives of British state interests and the Jewish world dictatorship. Whilst England is exhausting herself in maintaining her position in the world, the Jew is organizing his measures for its conquest. Thus, the Jew today is a rebel in England, and the struggle against the Jewish world menace will be started there also." Quote, again from Hitler, "No sacrifice would have been too great in order to gain England's alliance. It would have meant renunciation of the colonies and importance at sea, and refraining from interference with British industry by competition." Says Ramsey, "In later years, these two themes were ceaselessly expounded, viz., see the Jewish Marxist menace and the eagerness for friendship with Britain." These are two big German themes under the Nazis. "Even down to and including Dunkirk, Hitler pressed the latter idea on all and sundry, even on his highest generals, to their astonishment. Nor did he stop at words, as will be shown later when, as Liddell Hart informs us, he saved the British army from annihilation by halting the Panzer Corps, informing his generals the while that he regarded the British Empire and the Catholic Church as necessary bulwarks of peace and order which must be safeguarded." Again, Hitler regarded the British Empire and the Catholic Church as necessary bulwarks of peace and order which must be safeguarded. Yet today both of those have been destroyed because they did not understand, or they did not have the ability to operate, to cooperate with Hitler to destroy Bolshevism. As Audenyke said, it needed to be nipped in the bud before it became a global contagion. Says Ramsey, "Mein Kampf was first published in October 1933. Before it had left the printers, the floodgates of Jewish hatred and lies had been full opened against Hitler and the Third Reich all over the world. English-speaking peoples everywhere were deluged with fabrications, distortions, and atrocity stories which drowned out the voices of the few who understood the real situation. Forgotten in the turmoil was Marx's slogan that, before Bolshevism could triumph, the British Empire must be destroyed." Remember, Ramsey is British himself, and he's writing this book for the British people. So he says, Marx said that before communism could triumph internationally, the British Empire would have to be destroyed. Marx wanted to destroy the British Empire, whereas Hitler wanted to save it. Today it's been destroyed because the British teamed up. The British were manipulated, as were the Americans, into coming into the war on the side of the Jews. Totally suppressed as far as the British people were concerned was Hitler's repeated declaration of his willingness to defend the British Empire if called upon to assist by force of arms if necessary. So, the British people were lied to about Hitler, and they just as they continue to be lied about Hitler today, and it's cool to hate things German in Britain, even though the empire has been destroyed, and now the island itself is being destroyed through the Jew-fostered importation of the mud races of the world. And I think that will end our story today. That's the end of Chapter 5. So we did 3 to 5 in Radio Astina number 25 today, and this is September 16th, 2008. And I think we'll leave it there. This entire book has about 12 chapters, so we have about 6 to go. We may have repeated. I don't know if I did. I may have done the Russian Revolution in an earlier time, but it doesn't hurt to repeat it and to see that this is what the very best, most loyal people in the West were saying about the Jews and what they're doing to the world, and relating this to common news events as we did earlier when we talked about the Jewish misrepresentation of the homosexual scandal within the Catholic Church. Anyway, I thank you for listening to me today, and I will be back next Tuesday with Radio Astina number 26. I'm going to play, let's see, what do I have? I'm going to play 3 or 4 songs now, and then I will turn it off. I'll play the songs up to the top of the hour, and then we'll shut it down. So once again, Alex Linder, Radio Astina, signing off. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Then they came along in their giant truck, and they knocked you down. You should have seen yourself lying there all broken. Whoa. Gravity, it got you
gonna do me in. Whoa, whoa, whoa.